In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
South Dakota Democrats prepare for a new candidate. From SDPB, today is Monday, July 22nd, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, South Dakota Democrats and Independents chose their candidate during the state primary. Now that candidate has stepped aside. What's next? Dan Ahlers joins us. Wildfire season in the Black Hills calls for increased safety precautions. We'll talk with our state fire meteorologist. We welcome David O'Hara back to the program, this time as a member of the latest Bush Fellowship cohort. Plus, a Mitchell Window Art Contest and a Lunar Life exhibit in Brookings. Those conversations are later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. It has been a hot and dry summer in the Black Hills, and we are looking at another hot and dry week ahead of us. So let's check in on the state's wildfire outlook. Darren Klebo is the state fire meteorologist, and he's with us on the phone. Dr. Klebo, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me once again.
For people who don't remember, remind us what happened over the winter and how that has laid the groundwork for the fire season this summer.
Well, I'm going to really focus on snowfall, and especially across the western third of South Dakota. As we all know, eastern South Dakota has had a lot of precipitation issues with too much, and of course, western South Dakota hasn't had enough. But going through the winter, we really kind of had a mini snow drought, and what I mean by that is we just didn't get the normal amount of snowfall. And how that impacts our wildfire season now is without snow on the fuels, the big, heavy, deadened down materials, without that snow on them, those fuels are going to continue to dry throughout the wintertime and into the spring. And that's exactly what we saw. Really coming into the month of March, our bigger fuels on the landscape, especially within the Black Hills, were exceptionally dry. We didn't have a lot of snow, so there was no water to percolate down into the soil structure system. And so we really kind of had a dry winter. And then to set the stage for where we are now, April was actually a really wet month for western South Dakota. But once second week of May or so hit, we really started drying out. And frankly, May and June were phenomenally dry across western South Dakota, anywhere from 30% to maybe 60% of our average precipitation during the months of May and June. And those are our two wettest months. And so when we're, racking up those precipitation deficits during our wet months, it really sets the stage for fire activity during the peak summer. And here we are.
Yeah, here we are. What are we seeing right now? And then let's move into the outlook.
So the past couple of days has been all right. Actually, the past week, we've seen after that hot spell we've had last week, we saw temperatures definitely moderate, and we did see some precipitation. Now, it came in the form of thunderstorms, which, of course, brought lightning, and we did have some small fires associated with that. The precipitation that did hit some places really hard, but, of course, with thunderstorms this time of the year, some places missed that precipitation altogether. Today going to midweek, it's going to be near average to now bumping up towards, above average conditions towards Wednesday. But really, I've got my eyes on Thursday and Friday. It's going to be exceptionally hot. Some places might even see record heat for the time of the year. Temperatures in the low to mid 100s across the western South Dakota prairies, upper 80s to upper 90s within the Black Hills, which is pretty exceptional.
Yeah.
The one thing that's got me concerned, though, is the wind. We have not seen wind yet this summer, and Thursday and Friday have the potential to be windy days.
Mm. All right. So it seems like when we talk often about air quality and fires from the American West or fires from Canada that impact our air quality, the fear is that a wildfire can be quite massive and spread quickly. Are we prepared to fight fire in the Black Hills. Tell us a little bit about those preparations, where you feel our strengths are, and if there are any areas of concern for you.
Well, I think our strengths are the interagency partnerships that we have in the Black Hills. South Dakota Wildland Fire works very closely with all of the interagency partners that we have, the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, our partners at the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and our volunteer fire departments. We have an exceptionally strong wildland fire response from our volunteer fire departments. So we have the personnel and the partnerships in place to successfully fight wildfire. But I think the one worry, if I'll call it a worry right now, is nationwide, we're in what's called a preparedness level of 5, which is the highest it goes, which means there's a big strain on nationwide resources. And when I say nationwide resources, I mean air tankers and helicopters and hotshot crews, those types of things, because of all the fire activity in California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, that's going on right now. And so if we do get a big fire in the Black Hills, I think we're well prepared. We have a couple of single engine air tankers. We do have some helicopters at the Custer Helitac base. But yeah, if we're looking for the big national assets, it might be a struggle to get them. But I have full faith in our local VFDs and our interagency partnerships that we'll be fine.
As we look at heightened tourism season in, you know, a town like Custer or the upcoming Sturgis Rally, what kinds of pathways do we have for evacuation and notification in the event of a wildfire? What do people who might be listening to public radio right now but are new to the area need to know?
Well, I think the biggest thing is just to be prepared. If you're from out of state or from out of the area, recognize that the Black Hills are a forest ecosystem that is very susceptible to fire. So I think the number one thing that folks can do is just maintain personal responsibility. Make sure if you are having a campfire, first of all, check out your fire restrictions from the local county web pages. Make sure you're not in a fire restriction. And if you're not, you know, enjoy your campfire safely. We love everybody to enjoy the great Black Hills in western South Dakota. Notifications-wise, it just all kind of depends on where the fire is at and how critical it would be. So I would just say the best thing folks can do that are coming in from out of the area is, you know, stay tuned to the news. Keep up on you know, what your campgrounds are saying locally. Talk to our local folks. They're going to be out and about ensuring that everyone's going to have a safe and fun next couple of weeks.
Yeah. Any final thoughts that you have with us, either in the prevention standpoint or other things you want to raise awareness about here for our wildfire season?
Well, yeah, I'm sure everybody knows, but Sturgis is coming up, and we're going to welcome, you know, a few hundred thousand extra visitors to western South Dakota. So anytime that our local folks that might be a little bit more wise when it comes to wildfire preparedness, anytime you have a chance to interact with folks that are coming in from out of state, you know, just have a conversation about it and let them know that we all want them to have a safe and wonderful time here.
Yeah. Darren Clabo, State Fire Meteorologist. Dr. Clabo, thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
Yesterday, President Joe Biden dropped out of the 2024 presidential race. This is after some of the state Democrats cast their vote for him in June's primary. So we are welcoming Dan Ahlers back to the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls with an update. Dan is Executive Director of the South Dakota Democratic Party. Welcome back, Dan. Thanks for being here.
Excited to be on.
A statement just out this morning from the South Dakota Democrats really lauding President Joe Biden's service and calling this stepping away an act of selflessness. So let's start there. Tell me a little bit about how you are looking at the president and the decision to not be a candidate.
Well, you can just look at a laundry list of bipartisan accomplishments that he has had during his 4 years. Quite possibly the most impactful president of any of our lifetime. You have to go back to Johnson in 68 with Medicare and Medicaid and the Civil Rights Movement, or Roosevelt with the New Deal to see anyone that has had this much impact. And even as Governor Noem recognized in her RNC speech how great the South Dakota economy is doing. That's in large part to these investments from the Biden administration, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which none of our congressional members supported, but has certainly brought in billions of dollars to our state in broadband, water and sewer, roads, bridges, you name it. There's been a lot of work done, and we're extremely thankful for all of that. His decision to step down is just another example of what an exceptional leader does, where they put the people ahead of their own personal desires. And I just want people to think for a second, you know, if the shoe were on the other foot and it was Donald Trump, would he do the same thing?
There have been some Republicans who have questioned his ability to remain president. Do you see a distinction between his ability to run for office and what that decision he's made? Can he finish out the term in a strong way based on his health and some of the other things that the people have expressed concern about?
That's just partisan rhetoric. I mean, what you've seen from the president, what he's able to do, he's still maintained a very active schedule. He just met with United Nations. He's working on a lot of projects. And I really challenge anyone to keep a schedule like that. Even at 81, most of us would have a difficult time and find it quite stressful doing it at 30, 40, and 50.
All right, let's talk about what's next. What's next?
That is a great question. You know, President Biden has thrown his support behind Vice President Kamala Harris. She is an exceptional individual, a very accomplished person professionally, and has also been part of this administration, which has done so much for the people of this country and for the state of South Dakota. So if she becomes the nominee, I know we will throw our full support behind her. Many of our delegates are very excited about a Harris candidacy. Right now, we're just waiting to hear what the rules are going to be for the convention. I know there's a rules committee meeting tomorrow, and then we're going to meet immediately after that to get the download, and we'll meet with our delegates, and then we're going to move forward.
So the promise is from the National Party, transparency and order. It's going to be orderly and it's going to be transparent. I think everybody, since this is unprecedented, right?
Right.
Everybody is concerned about there being, you know, chaos. How do you feel about the opportunity for, or do you think it's going to be orderly when it is unprecedented like this?
Well, I'm not nervous. I'm pretty excited about this entire experience. I'm not even a delegate. I'm the one that has to wrangle all of them. But I really think that we're living in an exceptional time with a great opportunity moving forward. I've never seen Democrats so energized as they are coming out of this, both in their excitement for what the president has done and this selfless act and his exceptional leadership, but the opportunity of having a new generation take over as our party's candidates. So I think as I said, we have a rules committee meeting tomorrow. We'll know more coming out from there. We'll certainly be working with the media to get all of the information out. Just excited and ready to go.
Yeah, so there's not another primary, but then going into the convention, they will pick a new candidate and those delegates will shift in some way. So that's what we're waiting for more information about. Do I understand you clearly?
Yeah, yeah, and then we're also dealing with an Ohio law that it's not uncommon for conventions to interfere with a state law and when the candidate needs to be given to the Secretary of State to get on the ballot. Those are usually technicalities. The Ohio Republican Party decided to play some games with that process with our national convention. And then later, the governor there ushered in a special session, got a statute passed to change it, but they didn't have the two-thirds vote to make it to give it an emergency clause. So it did not take effect immediately, which meant it required 90 days. That 90 days would occur after our convention, mm-hmm. So it still wouldn't be law. It would present an opportunity for a legal challenge for whomever our candidate would have been, whether it had been Biden or now Vice President Harris, whoever it might be, to actually appear on the ballot in Ohio. It's very similar to our state legislature. If we have an emergency clause on it and it passes, it takes effect immediately when the governor signs it. If it doesn't, then it takes place July 1st. In this case, because it didn't have the emergency clause, it'll take 90 days. And so that still puts that in jeopardy. So that's why we're trying to figure out what this process is going to look like and to do it, like you said, in an orderly fashion to make it fair, to make it transparent. And I'm sure we'll know more by tomorrow.
So if the candidate is, in fact, Kamala Harris, that name needs to be on a ballot in November. And that needs to happen in every single state, a state like Ohio, incredibly important, not only as a swing state, but where Vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance is from, right? This
exactly.
is from Ohio. Okay. Yep. All right. So the opportunity, you've said a couple times that you're excited. Obviously, it goes without saying this is a huge challenge as well, just from a logistics standpoint and a legal standpoint. What are you excited about for the future? Because it's July and this election is in November. It's a short period of time. I mean, not really, but from what we have come to expect that presidential elections go on much longer than we used to think they did, it feels like a short period of time. What's the opportunity, especially when it comes to the down ballot races, the ballot questions in South Dakota? What are you looking forward to leaning into between now and November?
Well, I think sometimes that you find out how good you are when you're under pressure. I was once a replacement candidate, and I came in at the end of July and in 2006 and won my election. People said, don't worry, you're not going to win anyways. But if you, it really speaks to the quality and caliber of the leadership and the candidates when you can hit that ground running and you work hard. And I think you're going to see that. The energy within the Democratic Party is high. People are going to work hard. They're going to come together. And I think we're going to show up. I'm just excited about this opportunity. It's just a once-in-a-lifetime type of situation, and I think we're going to make the most of it. And I think folks are going to see some good things from the Democratic Party.
Dan Ehlers, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, the 2024 Bush Fellows have been announced, and South Dakota has some familiar faces among the 24 new fellows from across the Midwest. David O'Hara is a professor, an environmentalist, and an advocate for sustainable change. He teaches at Augustana University. He's a professor of philosophy, classics, and environmental studies. He's also the director of their sustainability program, and he's with us now in the Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. David O'Hara, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori. It's great to be with you, as always.
This is another situation where I think I know so much about you because of the years that we've been in conversation, mm-hmm. but I don't know much about your family. And in your Bush Fellowship reporting, it talks about the influence of both your parents. So I would love to hear more about your mom and dad and some of the things that they taught you growing up that are still impacting the way you see the world today.
Oh, yeah. I feel very fortunate to have had such amazing parents. My mom was driven by a desire to see good things happen for other people. She worked as director of rehabilitation at the county jail in our little rural county in upstate New York for 25 years. And people there came to know her as Mother Nancy because she was always looking to get people their GED, get into rehab, yeah. do whatever they needed to do to get back on their feet and live productive and healthy lives. And some of my memories from my dad raising me are him teaching me things like how to repair things rather than throw them out, how to walk in the woods quietly and pay attention to what was around me, and both my parents, how to grow my own food, how to build things with my hands. I'm really grateful for those lessons.
Was there a time that you felt, because not all of us take the things that our parents taught us and make them our own, was there a time that you felt like this is influencing me, but it is also worth keeping in the world? Like, were you in college? Were you an adult? Was it always part of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think the things that I saw in my parents, the things that I've just talked about, are things that from my brother and sister and me, from our earliest years, we valued. We all went through our rebellions. I mean, what kid doesn't, right? But those things that I just named, I think, are all things that even when we were little, we thought, these are things that we want to continue. And each of us, my brother and sister and I, have kind of done them in our own way. But yeah, our parents gave us a lot of good gifts, and we want to give those gifts to our children and to our communities.
Why the Bush Fellowship for you? What was the moment where you thought, this is something I'm going to apply for, and this is the right time for me to apply for it?
Well, one thing that makes the timing easy is I happen to have a sabbatical upcoming. So I thought, and I'm on sabbatical right now, why not start to do something new with a sabbatical? Sabbatical is about renewal and about deepening what you have and starting over. But I've also had some good role models, like a certain radio host that I know, and one of my colleagues, Willett Capers, somebody that I'd never met personally, but I know online, David Whitesock. Others kept saying to me, "You should apply for this. You should apply." So I decided, this year I'm gonna go for it. I found the process of applying really helpful. It made me think about what is it that I really want to do with this next stage of my life.
Yeah, so did I. The process of, because it is an ongoing process. It's not one application.
Right.
it is months of reconsidering. You get a mentor and a guy to sort of look at some of your early thoughts and say, well, have you thought about this? Or sort of reframe things for you. I found that incredibly clarifying, as I also found the cohort itself to be so humbling and clarifying, and the things that they were saying to me during my fellowship, my cohort, were life-changing. Someone would say something, I'd be like, that just changed my life. Like, I didn't see it like that, and you did. Are you having that similar experience after your first retreat?
Oh, my goodness,
of being with these people that are in your cohort?
Yeah. I mean, I went in there not knowing any of them, and I came out of it just feeling in awe. Like, why am I included in this company of amazing people with all these big ideas that they want to do? That's pretty fantastic. Yeah. And like you said, in the not just the retreat, but it was 9 months of application and just going through essays and meeting with people. And they ask questions like, what are you most proud of? And I got to say, you know, as a proper Midwesterner, even though I didn't grow up here, somebody asks you, well, what are you most proud of? And you're supposed to say, no, oh, I'm not proud. And they just pressed me on that. What am I proud of? Mm-hmm. And that got me thinking, well, I'm proud of my kids. I'm proud of my wife. I'm proud of the people that I work with and I've been able to hire. And honestly, proud of some of the things that I've been able to build. And now I want to do more of that. It was a good question to ask and good to have to confront that, you know, that kind of deep-seated resistance to saying that there are things that I'm proud of.
Yeah. I had a conversation with one member of the cohort, and I was talking about a work I wanted to do or a story I wanted to do, and I said, I just don't think that that's something I can do. Yeah. That would be too controversial or it would be too difficult. And he looked at me and said, but you have a license for that. Hmm. And I was like, journalists don't have a oh, wait, I know what you mean. And so sometimes just being challenged to see somebody else say, wait a minute, if you're a journalist and you're not going to do that thing, if you're not brave enough to do that story, we're relying on you to be the person who does it because you are a journalist. That is your license,
right?
Is what he was telling me. And that's been an incredible mantle to carry that expectation, help me see journalism in a new way.
Yep.
What are some of the things that you are planning on doing with your fellowship time?
Yeah, so the biggest thing is I want to learn. I get to be a student again. This is a great thing. Every teacher should get to be a student again. So there are some things that I've been working on with my students for a long time. A lot of them have to do with sustainability. How do we make sure that the things that we've got right now in front of us, we can pass them on to the next generation in just as good or better form than we had? How do we be not just loving our neighbors, but loving those who will come after us too? I want to be a good ancestor. So I want to go around. I'm going to travel and visit the people who are doing the kinds of things that I think we could be doing. I see some big changes that we could make where the state could be setting a model for the world. And there are little bits and pieces that other people have done, but no one's kind of done the interdisciplinary work of putting them together. And I want to learn how to be the kind of leader who helps other people do that work. I don't need to make a name for myself. What I really want to do is help other people make the good kinds of changes that we could make here.
So talk about that as a professor. Because as I said before, I followed you for a long time. And you are consistent with your devotion to your students and helping them do what you just said. You will, after the sabbatical, continue to teach mm-hmm. and help that next generation of people, whether it's at Augie or, yeah. or beyond in the community, as you often do. Why is that important to you? Why is teaching so much a part of who you are? Because not every college professor is there to be a teacher first. Many are there to do their own research. They get tenured, you know, and that's not an insult. I just, as a student, you often can distinguish the professors who are there and you're really happy to learn alongside them and the professors who are so devoted to your development. Why is that important to you?
That's a great question. And you're right. I've got colleagues who are amazing researchers, so much smarter than I could ever dream of being. I just love being around students and watching these ideas kind of flourish and blossom in their minds and then saying, well, I've got some resources. As a teacher, I can help you to grow those ideas. Let's go back to my parents. My parents were both, in a way, teachers. They've both done a little bit of teaching, but they saw potential in other people and then helped to nurture it. And I saw that as a great model, and I just want to carry it on.
Yeah. I was in Hawaii last week for my final fellowship journey for a variety of reasons, including the fact that I lived there for 4 years, was stationed at the base, and had gone back to do some specific things. And one of the things that I was just undone by was the diversity of plant life.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost to the point where I didn't know what I was seeing until, because my experience in the Black Hills National Forest is, you know, it's very monoculture. I mean, there's a lot of pine trees, not entirely, but compared to what I saw in Hawaii, I was like, oh, this is what I'm seeing. How can these things be in the same place?
Yeah.
And then I realized what I was looking at was something I don't have language for because I'm not a scientist, but the diversity in plant life, the biodiversity.
Right.
I was seeing it for the first, I was seeing it anew.
Yeah.
And I thought of you and I thought, is it too late to save places like this? Is it too late when we talk about sustainability, when we talk about what we are willing to sacrifice as humans to protect things? Where do you come at that? The feeling that some young people have, that the feeling of despair, that too much has been lost.
Right.
You know, an endangered species wandered across the path from us.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this is the first time I've seen an endangered species outside of a zoo.
Yeah.
Or a photograph.
Yep.
And here they are.
You and I have both been traveling. A couple of days ago, I was in the Pacific Ocean in Costa Rica, working with some sea turtle scientists, helping them to do research on another endangered species, a species of sea turtle. And you could become overwhelmed when you realize just how much has been threatened. I mean, look at our Big Sioux River. It's kind of a mess. I don't want my kids drinking it. I don't want to swim in it right now. It used to be clear as glass, but a century or more ago. So yeah, you could get desperate. We've talked about this before. I'm a Christian. I'm a pragmatist as a philosophy professor. I'm a little bit of a stoic, and I'm going to look at the world and say, yeah, there are some messes that I can't clean up. But right in front of me, I've got these students who have hope, who have good ideas, who want to love their neighbors as themselves, who want to be good ancestors. I might not be able to change everything, but I can encourage and foster the good things that are already alive right in front of me. And, you know, your experience in Hawaii, seeing that diversity of plants and diversity of flowers, animals, et cetera. Yeah, I get that, too. And I want us to notice here in South Dakota that we aren't flyover country.
Yeah.
We are this immense, rich, gorgeous landscape. But so many of the lives here are really, really small. Like the native bees, not just the honeybees, but the native bees that live all by themselves and that don't sting, most of them. They pollinate our food, and we don't even notice them. And so we spray insecticide and think, well, that must have been a mosquito or something because they're so small. And we depend upon them. I want us to get to know our neighbors, including the little bees, and to do what we can to care for them so that the generations that come later, my great-great-grandchildren, will look back and say, gosh, I'm glad that Dave did the things that he did.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to go really far away and to come back and look at your own backyard.
That's right.
Afresh.
Yeah, that's right. I think everyone should travel. Mm-hmm. Not everyone should be a tourist, but everyone should travel in order to learn and then come back and see the place where you live with fresh eyes.
Tell me about your writing practice as you travel.
Yeah.
Do you take field notes? Do you journal? Because I struggled with that. I was overwhelmed by all the things I was seeing, and then all of a sudden I was out of words.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, okay, you don't have to have all the words right now, but put a few things down. Put some field notes. Put some observations down. Do a couple recordings.
Yep.
Trust that process. But it was inadequate to the task of the size of what. So you have more experience than I do in this. How do you keep a writing practice or a field note practice? What would you call it?
And, yep.
And let me peek inside that notebook for a minute.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I actually have a notebook in my pocket, and yeah. I always do. If somebody tells me their name, I write it down quickly. I write sketch notes. It doesn't have to be beautiful prose, whatever your middle school English teacher said. Just write stuff down right now. Don't wait until much later to catch up. I also carry a bigger notebook, which I've got right here next to me as well. I carry notebooks with me all the time. And when I get a chance to sit down in a coffee shop or something, I'll write for a few minutes and just kind of review the day. I want to make sure to review the day every day if I can. I also, when I was going in Costa Rica, I had 5 cameras with me, so I take pictures of insects. I set up trail cameras to kind of catch what's going by when I'm not looking. And I had a sketchbook. One of the art professors at Augustana put out this challenge this summer to take 20 minutes a day to sketch what you see. Not to do fine art. We don't all have to be Picasso or Van Gogh. Just to sketch. And I find the practice of sketching for just a few minutes, of trying to draw what you see, winds up slowing you down and helping you to see better, even if you never show anybody what you sketched.
Yeah.
So your writing can be like that too. It's not about trying to write the great American novel or the great American nature work. I mean, I'm preaching to the choir, you know this, but we're trying to make sure that this thing that is right here in front of us right now doesn't get lost. When you're with somebody that you love, you take time to look in their eyes, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've seen their eyes before. Do you really need to look in their eyes? Yeah, you do. Like, you look in their eyes because yeah. there's that moment of deepening the connection, you know, touching their hand, whatever. Writing can be a little bit like that, too. It's a way of kind of looking in the eyes of what's around us right now. And if you allow yourself to slow down, not be distracted by all the other stuff, but to kind of gaze into the moment that's right in front of you by writing. It doesn't have to be beautiful prose. Here's a college professor telling everyone listening, it doesn't have to be beautiful prose, but just write it down and you've got something then to go back to and kind of deepen writing later on if you want yeah. to.
I want to leave people with this because for people who aren't familiar with your work, they don't know what you have been through in your life. And there was a time when you suffered a terrible accident.
Mm-hmm.
You were public about that.
Yep.
So I'm not revealing any secrets. And did you think, were there days that you thought, I won't be able to do what you're doing right now?
Oh, yeah.
For the people who are in that spot now, help them understand how to get to the other side where they can do the thing.
Yeah.
Like, you might be having a really bad day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll fill in your listeners who might not know. I'm a cancer survivor, and I'm also somebody who was in a bad accident, traumatic brain injury, penetrating traumatic brain injury. I have some pretty bad brain damage. It left me unable to write. I couldn't type. I couldn't move a pen. I've studied a lot of languages, and I lost ability in all of them, including in English. And I had a lot of broken bones besides, and it was a long and slow process of recovery. Thankfully, I had a supportive community,
mm-hmm.
my wife, my children, my workplace. And little by little, I've tried to gain those things back. I'm not as good a writer as I was before. I'm not as good a speaker or teacher, I think, as I was before. But you know what? We all age. Everything changes. And that's what I have, I'm going to use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as I've got these things, I've got a little bit of brain left.
A little.
Yeah, a little bit. I can't run as fast as I once could. I've got these injuries.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I have this amazing world. And I've got people that I enjoy talking to, that I enjoy teaching. And I get great hope from the thought that the people around me might do amazing things. I don't have to do amazing things. I just have to care about these people who someday might be doing something even greater. Let me leave you this anecdote. Last November, All Saints Day, as I was driving into work, I was thinking about, what does this mean, All Saints Day? It's like the day, the catch-all for all the other saints, right? And I was thinking about, there's all these people in all sorts of traditions that we think of as saints. Each one of them at one point was a kid. And I'm going in to teach a bunch of kids, you know, they're 18 to 22 years old, but kids in my classrooms. And it hit me. which one of them might someday, maybe 1,000 years from now, be thought of as a saint? And what's my role if I get to be with that person today and help them just a little further along the way? I don't want to impede them, and I want to help their garden to grow. What can I do? That gives me hope. Yeah. That's why I want to teach. That's what my parents did for me. It's what I see going on in the world. I want other people to enjoy and participate in that too.
Well said. One of our 2024 Bush Fellows from South Dakota, David O'Hara, thanks so much for stopping by. We're looking forward to walking alongside you with this new journey.
Thanks, Lori.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Artists in Mitchell were invited to take artistic inspiration from this theme, literary inspirations. And their artwork will grace the town's main street for this year's Mitchell Main Street Window Art Contest. It was organized by the Mitchell Area Council of the Arts, Mitchell Main Street and Beyond, and the Mitchell Area Chamber of Commerce. Dana Kolbeck is president of the Mitchell Area Council of the Arts and is with us from Dakota Wesleyan University in the Dan and Diane Desloria's family studio. Dana, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the contest in general, how it began, and how you invite participants.
We started this about 2 years ago in 2022 when we had some ideas between the Mitchell Main Street and Beyond Chamber and the Council about beautifying downtown and making it unique to our community. We have some gorgeous historical buildings, but there was some construction from where the second level is from tenants and possibly building owners that wasn't exactly the most beautiful part of Mitchell. So we had this idea to give Mitchell Main Street a beautiful makeover with these windows and to do it annually. So we cover up anything that's unsightly, but anybody who lives in the apartments can still view out. And it just gives you unique Mitchell its own kind of vibe, whereas we don't have a sculpture walk yet, but we have kind of a window art walk going on.
A window art walk. I love that. Different categories from children to adults. Tell me a little bit about that.
We'd love to have the opportunity available to anyone and anybody who may have a creative inspiration in their life. I've always been a huge advocate. When I started the council, I wanted it to be something that anybody at any age level could start doing. I wanted children to have the opportunity, and I wanted anybody all the way up to veterans who might not have any sort of output to have kind of a billboard of their own. And so there's no fee to apply. And we try to keep the themes themselves really generalized so that they're not too restrictive in creativity. And it can be submitted in crayon, marker, people who are really into graphic arts on their computers. It's very fluid with how much we are welcoming anybody to apply.
Yeah. And this year you went with literary inspirations. What kinds of submissions did you get? Tell me a little bit about the process when submissions start coming in and you just say, oh, I didn't expect that. Tell me what that was like.
We had some really great applications this year. A lot of color. We had a lot of Poe. We had a lot of, I was actually surprised at a little bit of the horror category. We had some Goosebumps, which I had not even thought of, but for some people, that is really an introduction into the literary world, is getting into those Goosebumps books when you're a child and really getting into that. That's awesome. Classics like The Black Beauty. We have people who submitted Where the Wild Things Are, names that you just know inherently that you associate with like your local library or just your childhood. It's wonderful to see the submissions and the amount of color that was submitted this year.
Yeah, I love that. I noticed that too, the color, the use of color and the vibrancy of this, which as you say, you know, gives Mitchell its own vibe, as in vibrant colors. Tell me about, now are the windows up?
No, they are not up yet because we try, but for the last 2 years we've been doing this, we've coincided with the Main Street's actual streetscaping. So the first year we did with 5th and Main, and so those are above Crazy About Cupcakes and Craig Ryan's right there on 5th and Main, so you can see last year's submissions. And then this year's will be on 3rd and Main, where the actual street has been redone and we have bump outs and there's going to be beautiful greenery. It's all going to be nice. A great presentation this fall when it's actually when they're applied up on the windows. So we just have to wait, you know, yeah. a little bit for construction, but then they're going to be up.
So tell me, as we wrap things up, someone's at your door. That's hilarious. Okay, we have to wait. Well, the community of Mitchell and what this sort of means, you know, what do you hope happens as people are walking by and they're talking about things? Leave us with some final thoughts on that. All right. I think what we're doing here is maybe adjusting a little bit in that studio. So we're going to keep going with Dana for... Yes, one more question, Dana. Just tell us a little bit about the community and how you hope that they'll be interacting with that, with the art really when it comes up.
Absolutely. I really hope that we can do that this fall, and then it will coincide with maybe one of our first Fridays down on Main, which is put on by the Mitchell Main Street Beyond Committee. They do a great job of bringing people down to Main Street, not only tourists, but the local residents here as well. We have such a great space for it on Main Street, and it's just beautiful with our historic buildings that are slowly being, you know, repaired a little bit each yeah. year or upkept. It's just gorgeous down there.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We'll work on the audio from our Dakota Wesleyan University studio in the days ahead. But Dana, you're a good sport handling the adjustments there, and I'm excited to see stop by Mitchell and take a look at what's new. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Dana Kolbeck, president of the Mitchell Area Council of the Arts. Up next, a new exhibit at the Children's Museum of South Dakota invites kids to don their flight suits and shoot for the moon. Lunar Life, give kids a taste of the everyday life of an astronaut. Mike Mogart is the Director of Operations at the Children's Museum of South Dakota, and Kay Cutler is Professor of Early Childhood Education at South Dakota State University. They helped create the exhibit, and they are joining us via Zoom. Mike Mogart, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Laurie. Thanks for having us.
Kay Cutler, thank you as well.
Thank you.
All right, Kay, let's start with you from the early childhood education vantage point. Kids probably are pretty excited about space and the night sky from an early age. Tell me a little bit about Lunar Life as an exhibit, and then we'll bring Mike in to talk about what it looks like at the Children's Museum.
Well, the Lunar Life exhibit was designed with multiple levels of children in mind, and it was something that was designed by five different interdisciplinary teams, working with interior design majors and mechanical engineering majors and early childhood education and entrepreneurial studies and then advertising and marketing. And so this was a three-year design process with undergraduates and also a couple graduate students. And so they were working on different experiences for children based on the research that they did with what NASA is currently doing regarding the moon.
Mm. Mike, tell us a little bit about the Children's Museum working with this interdisciplinary team and project.
You know, at our museum, we love collaboration. We love to collaborate. And so this is a perfect example of that, of working with not only with SDSU, but with the students in the different departments and different areas of study to come up with something that is better than any individual department or any individual group would be able to come up with. In my mind, I feel like that collaboration is the biggest key to this exhibit and getting it into the hands of kids.
Yeah. And the exhibit is great, but learning, building the exhibit was that learning experience. What, as you work with, you know, partners and collaboration, Mike, what are some of the things that you learned that were unexpected to you?
This, you know, our exhibit design, this was completely different than anything else we've done before because of turning it over. We use kids in the design of our exhibits, But this was a different realm of that. The kids that we usually use are elementary age or younger kids. And so this was college age kids that were helping to design this, but really making sure that for an exhibit in our space, that it is hands-on, obviously, is a huge key, that there are loose parts, things that our guests can pick up, move around, help build their own experience so that they're encouraged and anxious to come back and explore again in a different way the next time that they visit. And so having those keys are important. And then making sure that it's accessible to all ages and abilities is huge. But those are the things that we kind of seek out in our exhibit development, and this group really hit the mark on those.
Yeah.
It's always nice when a design team designs it for your space, and that was a big part of this one as well.
Yeah. Dr. Cutler, work is your play is the work of childhood. You know, I guess what I'm trying to get at is help us understand when you take your child to a place like the Children's Museum and they are playing and there are things they can pick up and put down and you just sort of are letting them loose in the space. How do you design a space that encourages the kind of play that kids that need?
Well, it really takes into account the different ages and what developmentally different ages of children are seeking and experimenting with in their play. And asking the question again and again as you design something, does this meet that? Does this meet a two-year-old's need for repetitive experimentation with different sounds? And there are places within the exhibit where that does that. For older children, does it meet the need for inventive spelling and literacy? And there are elements, there are note pads available so that they can take notes as they're doing things. Huh. Are there, you know, learning about how do you eat in space? How do you exercise in space? What does it look like in a research laboratory? And what are some of the things that you'd be doing there in space? As well as how do you communicate back to Earth? What does that look like? And so, you know, taking some time or stations to develop those in ways that younger children can access it as well as older children. We tried to put those layers in as we designed this.
Yeah.
Mike, and it's been a lot of fun to watch them play.
Yeah. And as a parent, I just, you know, anytime you go to the Children's Museum, Mike, give yourself some time. Don't expect to get in 30 minutes or an hour. Like, enjoy how much there is for kids to play and learn. Mike, we've got about 30 seconds left. Anything about the opening exhibit the opening of this exhibit that you want to leave listeners with as they plan their visit to the museum? Briefly.
So we opened it in May, got to live with it for a little bit, but we wanted to make sure that we took time to celebrate the exhibit. And so tomorrow night, from 5 to 7, we're doing that celebration, our liftoff event. We're going to have some of the people who helped with the design of the exhibit in the space to answer questions and talk about their role. We're going to have some straw rockets that are going to be guests can make and launch. We're going to have water rockets outside that guests can launch if they want to get a little bit wet. And then we're going to be showing a documentary about how the exhibit was developed, as well as reading a book about the Artemis mission. And so we're tying it into all the other exciting space-themed things that are happening around. But we just wanted to really celebrate that this is such a unique event and a unique exhibit and celebrate.
Thank you so much, Mike and Kay Cutler, Dr. Cutler and Mike Bogard. We appreciate your time. We'll put information up on our website as well. I'm Lori Walsh, and we thank you for listening.